Welcome to Improv Interviews with Margot Escott, a psychotherapist in Naples, Florida, who is using her 35 years of experience to develop improvisation programs, benefiting and improving the lives of those with emotional and physical challenges. Improv Interviews brings together the world's leading improvisational theater masters, founders, and innovators who are using improvisation therapeutically in unique and surprising ways. With great guests that include legends like Ed Asner and Aretha Sills, you're sure to learn something new about improvisation. This is Improv Interviews with your host, Margot Escott.
Well, today I have a fabulous guest, Matt Fotis, hailing from Pennsylvania. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Margot. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to have you. And Matt is a professor of improv acting and writing for the theater at Albright College in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's right. We're a liberal arts college about an hour or so outside of Philadelphia. And yeah, I teach all sorts of stuff, but the favorite things, of course, are writing and improv and comedy stuff.
So cool. And of course, he is an award-winning playwright, receiving the Mark Twain Prize for Comedy from the Kennedy Center, among his other accomplishments. And he has a dog named Wrigley. So these are probably the most salient facts I can give you about Matt right now. He's also written some tremendous books on improv. I want you to run out to Amazon now. Starting in 2012, Long Form Improvisation and American Comedy, The Herald. 2016, The Comedy Improv Handbook, co-written with Siobhan O'Hara. And Satire in the State, Sketch Comedy in the Presidency. And he's also, you can find wonderful articles he's written on satire. One that I'm in a writing class right now, writing a satire sketch for this week. Political Satire and the Age of Post-Truth. Wonderful piece. So enough about me, Matt. Let's talk about you. Where do you come from and where'd you grow up? And when did you get the acting or improv bug? Which came first?
Yeah, okay. So I grew up in the south suburbs of Chicago. So Midwest boy. And I did not start theater until I was in college. I grew up playing sports. Baseball was my jam. And I went to Monmouth College, which is out in Western Illinois, sort of between the Quad Cities and Peoria for anyone's sort of Midwest geography. And my brother had gone there as well. He's 2 years ahead of me. And he had gotten into theater in high school, but I really didn't. And one of his friends was directing, 10 minute play for a class type of thing. And, being theater at a small college, they needed men. So I auditioned and, it was Samuel Beckett's Rough for the Theater One. So it was a really, really easy piece to do. and I was terrible. As you could imagine, but it was such a cool experience and it really made me be like, oh, this is a lot of fun. I really like this. And, the people are really welcoming and nice. And so that was the second semester of my freshman year. And during that year, my brother was in the improv group there. He was one of the co-founders of it. I started going to their shows and I was like, oh, this is really cool. I really like this. And so I kind of like jumped into both traditional theater and improv kind of at the same time, but really sort of gravitated more to improv. As an introvert, it's always one of the weird things about improv that like introverts love improv. You think it would be like the worst thing in the world for us. But it felt like a place that I could like really use my voice. And it just felt like natural to do it.
Yes. Yes. For me, it felt like being home. All of a sudden I found a place with other misfits, Island of Misfits toys where I belonged.
Yeah. And so, and I was pretty good at it, and so it was just a lot of fun, and then got really into it in college, and working with the troupe there, and ended up meeting my wife through that. So even if I was bad at improv, I still came out ahead. Yeah, and then so I guess like the first part of my journey is just sort of like following my brother. And then I moved to Minneapolis after school because my brother moved to Minneapolis. And he's still there. He runs Strike Theater up in Minneapolis. So, and he does, he's sort of a comedy legend up there. And I spent a couple years up there. We were in a group together with some friends called Finger Gun. I took some classes at the Brave New Workshop.
A fabulous place.
Yeah,
Fabulous.
it's sort of like one of those hidden gem, like it shouldn't be a hidden gem, but right, it's like the oldest comedy theater in the country, right?
That's right.
And so yeah, I had a did some classes there, right, had a great time working there. And after a couple of years up there, I kind of decided that I wanted that I really enjoyed teaching a lot.
And were you teaching improv there? Did you?
Not a ton. I had done some college workshop stuff, and had sort of been doing some freelancing thing, but I wasn't like regularly teaching. But when I was doing it, I was like, oh, I really like this. And it was it, I felt like I could do more good that way. I think when you had Jeannie on, she was sort of Jeannie Leap, she was kind of talking about when you, this is back in the early 2000s, right? Like you sort of talked about improv, and if people weren't in improv, they had no idea what you were talking about. And so I thought I would go sort of study and write about and sort of developing my sort of teaching chops on improv. And so I decided to go get my master's at Illinois State, which is, about an hour and a half or so, depending on traffic, south of Chicago. And while I was there, I sort of had this like bifurcated identity of sort of young scholar in the Masters of Arts program. And then I was working really intimately and intensely with the student improv group, right, as one of the members there, and sort of kind of like split, right? Because the program there, has MFAs and it has MAs, and there's a lot of sort of focus on the MFAs, right? Do work, go out and do work. And there wasn't quite as much of an emphasis on the MAs going out and doing work. Not, I mean, it's not like they discouraged it. Like you can't do anything. And so that was a lot of fun. I met a lot of really cool people through that. A lot of folks who are in that group who are, doing some really great things, right? So Caitlin Barlow, who ended up right on the TV show Teachers, Adil Rifai, who's doing Hello from the Magic Tavern, Matt Castelvi, who's like this huge stand-up and stuff. So there's a lot of folks sort of came out of that world, which is exciting. And then I moved back to Chicago to do some theater and improv there. Did some classes and things at I.O.
Wonderful place, a wonderful school.
Yeah, great place. It was sort of one of those things. When I first got into improv, you're like, there's nothing, you just make it up and you do things, and then you realize like, oh, there's all these things you should be doing and thinking about. And then once you have that, then there's people who are like, no, don't think about anything, just something, right? And so that's sort of like I kind of find myself going back and forth between like IO philosophy and annoyance philosophy of like, all right, really key on the relationship, do all these things. And then there's the just do something type of aesthetic. And so, yeah, so I was doing theater, working as an accountant for a public relations firm, which was odd. And So I did that for about 4 years, and then my wife and I were about to have our first son, and so and my dad had gotten sick a couple years earlier, and he's good now. And so it was a kind of like, is this what I want to do? Right, work as an accountant all day with no training. I think they read my intro to acting as intro to accounting on my credit. And I was like, yes, that's right. So I was like, what do I really want to do? Right. Is it, I can keep doing this, and right, it's fun, it's whatnot. But I felt like, the time that I was at Illinois State, it was like, I really liked that time. And so I decided I was going to go get my PhD to try to like make the sort of scholarship and teaching, into my career. And so I went to the University of Missouri in Columbia. And one of the reasons I went there was because, right, their whole PhD program is really about sort of scholarship and artistry coming together. And so it's like, use the stuff that you're doing as an artist to inform, right, what you're sort of researching, and vice versa. And so I went down there, and that was a great 4 years there. Founded MU Improv there, which became a lot of the basis of the stuff that ended up in the Comedy Improv Handbook. Right, wrote my dissertation there on improv, and Jeannie kind of talked about this, right? Like, it's sort of, I was kind of trying to like get everybody on the in academia to be like, this is what we're doing, right? This is what this is, right? It isn't just sort of making stuff up, and that's it. And so I did what turned into the book Long Form Improv in American Comedy, The Herald. That was kind of like the basis of my dissertation, sort of turned into that. And then moved out here to Pennsylvania and Albright, and have been here now since 2012, which is kind of amazingly fast. And just right, really trying to keep doing the writing about improv, trying to sort of help establish it right for people. I mean, I think one of the weird ironies of improv is everybody outside of academic theater thinks improv is amazing and really valuable, and everybody in academic theater is like, improv's stupid.
Yeah, and that's why Jeannie said she wanted to write a book that could show academics the value and the importance of this art form. And Amy, of course, CM was a pioneer in putting the word out there.
And their two books are really sort of the foundation of like contemporary improv scholarship. Of course, there's like Janet Coleman's The Compass and Jeffrey Sweet's Something Wonderful Right Away, which are like, on those like pedestals, right? But in terms of like academic scholarship, right, the Amy's book and Jeannie's book are really like everything sort of comes out of them, right, in some way. And so now I'm at Albright teaching, running improv club here, and trying to write when I can write and perform when I can perform, and living the dream.
You really are. And I'm going to put this in the text that accompanies the podcast, but you've got your own YouTube channel, Matt Fotis Teaches Online. And there are some, I really loved your public service announcement about coronavirus and the late date night with Matt Fotis, where you're interviewing the university president, I think.
He's the dean of the arts, yeah.
The Dean of the Arts, yes, and asking him about money. That was really funny.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of grew out of the pandemic, right? When they were, it was like, go home for spring break. And then after spring break, they're like, hey, become an online teacher. So those videos kind of grew out of that.
Oh, and you were an online teacher then during the pandemic?
Yeah, well, not by choice, but everybody was. I mean, some classes were easier than others. I was teaching acting for the camera, which actually probably worked out great.
Yeah.
Because it was like, all right, now you're going to get a ton of experience on self-taping. And that's how now you audition for almost everything. So, but some other class, we were, running the improv group was a little tricky, but, one of the silver linings of that was, we still did some shows and things. And for a lot of folks, that was like the only time their parents could like see a show or like do something. So it was actually kind of cool. We sort of had a different audience for our shows, during COVID, but I think we're all glad to be back in person.
Yeah, I absolutely, my whole life is online. So that's my jam. But you said it was a little trick. Was it tricky teaching improv or doing improv shows online?
But both. I think once everybody kind of figured out how Zoom could work and sort of that give and take, in some ways it was a really great tool to teach listening, because if everybody's jumping in, right, then there's just sort of garble. So there were some things that I think were like really good lessons about, really intently listening to what the other person is saying and, waiting for your turn to respond. Probably the hardest thing was like warming up, how do you play Zip Zap Zop on Zoom, right? but yeah, I mean, I think it was good. And, we were able to like pull in some alumni for things. So like there were a lot of things that were really cool about it, sort of connect some generations, right? In ways that we always could have, but never did, So yeah, I think there are some definitely positive takeaways from it.
So what was your family like? Is just you and your older brother?
Yeah, me and my older brother, and he was, he got into theater in high school and now he's running a theater in Minneapolis, works for General Mills. And my parents, my dad is a pharmacist. my parents are not performers at all. My dad's a pharmacist. My mom was a school teacher, and she's a librarian now. I guess she used to write like a column for the local newspaper that was pretty funny. So that's probably the comedy probably comes more from her side. My dad, he likes to repeat jokes. So, in his mind, people aren't laughing at his jokes because they didn't hear it. But no, and I mean, they were great, like super supportive, to this day, are still supportive of us, right? Buy tickets to our shows and stuff. We're in our 40s and they're like, we bought a ticket to your show. couldn't ask for like more supportive,
great
environment to grow up in. So yeah.
That's great. And how many children do you have now?
I have three. Our oldest is 16. So we got two boys, 16 and 14. And then our youngest is a girl who's 12. She's super into gymnastics, which is terrifying. She's good enough now that it's terrifying, right?
Wow.
Like, the bends and flips and things. You're like, I can't watch. Right? She sends you videos and you're like, oh my God. Then our two boys have just started getting into theater. Through no pushing on our end. So they're both in Mamma Mia right now, which is a school play that opens next week. So we're all sort of in, that tech rehearsal mode. So they're out all night and stuff. But and then my wife is a preschool teacher / actor improviser. She's really big into Mr. Rogers and sort of using his kind of philosophy as like an improv philosophy.
Right.
And so she does a lot of stuff in her classes that's kind of like Mr. Rogers, Viola Spolin, kind of like mixed stuff, which is cool. And then Jeanette, my wife and I, we just started a sort of improv comedy series here in Reading that we're in the first year of, and we're kind of trying to build it up because there's a lot of There's a ton of local theater and a lot of music here, right? There's a big jazz festival here every year. There's not a lot of comedy or anything here, so we're trying to be like fill that void. And now our kids are old enough that we can leave the house.
And so you have a theater space you're working out of?
We work out of there's this place called the Goggle Works in Red.
The goggle works.
So it used to be a goggle factory. And it's got turned into then sort of repurposed as this really giant arts complex. And so there's a lot of artists of all kinds, sculptors, painters, musicians, right? You name it, are sort of in residency there, and they have a movie theater there. And so we perform in the movie theater's got a little stage. And it's kind of nice because, sometimes we can use the movie screen and that makes our stuff look cool. But there's not like other performance stuff there. So we're not like sharing it with another theater that's got like their set for, Mamma Mia. And then we're trying to sort of improvise around it. So we're trying to get that going here. And that's been fun to sort of re-put on some producer hat type things, and try to sort of develop that community here in Reading.
And what kind of improv are you doing there?
So we do sort of a mix of short form and long form. We have a couple of different kind of formats that sort of house it, but we're sort of trying to meet the audience where they probably are, and then kind of like show them some things that they probably haven't seen. So we'll do some short form games, just an audience is like, oh, I've seen that on Whose Line, and then suddenly they're like, yes. So we do some of that, and then we do some long form stuff, which Red Eyes is really good about. You just sort of I think in long form we sort of fall into the trap of like not explaining what you're going to do and then being like, how come the audience didn't get it? So we've been, trying to like really be like, okay, here's what we're going to do, right? Here's what the structure is. Here's what's going to happen, theoretically, fingers crossed. So our next show's in May. We're doing this forum called Scriptprov, that comes to us via Denver, and so it's sort of a. It's a nice mixture for an audience that isn't like super familiar with improv. So what happens is two scripted actors do just a normal scene, right, from a play or whatever. The improv company is not in the room, and then one of the actors from the scripted scene is removed. They're replaced with an improviser. The scripted actor who stays, right, they stay on script, and then the improviser just sort of has to go along, and they make up this totally new scene. And so it's a lot of fun, and it's good for audiences because it's like very transparent about like the format and the structure. The audiences, I always tell people like improv is just like an inside joke, right? And so the audience has the inside joke because they know they've seen the scene and they know that what the improviser is stepping into. So it's a lot of fun. And so we have that show coming up is on.
I just love that. I've been teaching lines from a hat or pick a play online, which is a bit of a challenge, but I love that. I'm taking note of that, Matt.
I wish I could say I came up with it, but
Is that a Denver, huh?
yeah, I'm blanking on the name. I could send you the name of the person who came up with it.
Okay.
And then we do some other things we try to do. We try to pull in once every couple of months, sort of pull in a group from some surrounding areas to just sort of try to build the community. It's a pretty good improv community in Philadelphia, but it's like just far enough away that it isn't convenient, right?
I want to ask you about your writing, since you are an award-winning writer, and you've written several. I found a list of some of the plays you've written, and one of them that I particularly liked was The Adventures of Menorah Man and Dreidel Boy, a play about Christmas.
Yeah, so that was it's a holiday show. And so it sort of it's from the hero is a Jewish teenage boy who's essentially his whole school kind of like celebrates Christmas kind of around him. And so he kind of like develops this superhero persona. And it turns out, right, that he's got to go save Christmas for everybody. It's a fun show. I sort of built it out of actually Elmo's holiday special. Our kids were at that age at that time, right? And so I saw that about 750 times. Sort of a cool idea, to write a holiday play. A lot of my I use improv a lot in writing. That idea of kind of like turn off your editor, right, and just sort of go and yes and ideas. And I've used some improv structures in writing before.
Which ones?
So one of my plays, the Can of Biography of a Chess Table in Central Park. It has a more complicated name than that. I can't remember, but that's a La Ronde. Right. So I've used that. Nights on the Couch is sort of like all these forms have different names.
Right.
Well, Chain Smoking, when I was probably not called that anymore. But sort of like taking a thread or a character from one and that sort of weaves us through it. So I've done that. And then probably in the last 5 years, sort of since the pandemic and a little bit before that, I've really been sort of specific writing for Albright, right? And sort of the students we have there and the people we have there. So trying to write things right specific to that audience, that demographic, that sort of casting pool. And then doing some devised stuff, right, at the school, and then do a sketch comedy show every year, not every year, every election year at the schools. And so that's always like the, am I gonna get fired show?
But you're teaching at a liberal arts college, right? Liberal?
We have a lot of first generation students, and we have a lot of we're a majority minority population. So, and I'm very openly liberal, so it's not like it's a surprise when you come to the show. But there's still plenty of people who on campus, which is great, who are like, that's, I hate that. Why are you doing that? That's wrong. Because the idea is hopefully it's to give people a sort of avenue or an opening door to, talk about stuff, right? And to get, students engaged and involved, right, with elections and right and our politics. So I have a point of view, and that's in the show. But really, it's like, hey, let's. I don't know that we make a lot of space, right, in general, but certainly for 18 to 22-year-olds to really like talk about stuff. So that's the idea, right? To use some comedy to kind of like spark conversation.
Beautiful. Now, I want to ask you about your writing process. Are you the kind of person that gets up every day and starts writing? Or what is your writing process?
Well, it depends. Creative writing wise, I tend to more so like if I'm writing a play or something, that tends to be more sort of bursty. So it's like a couple weeks sort of intensely writing, right? Big sort of writing block type things. And I sort of revise as I go. So, and the older I get, the more outlines I make. I don't know if that's good or bad. For the more sort of academic stuff, that is more like plow through it, kind of. Plus, that was a terrible way to describe it. Like half hour a day, right? Really sort of look at, setting a schedule, staying on schedule, meeting that schedule. Thinking about the writing process as involving, research is part of writing, reading is part of writing. So, I think most writers will tell you, right? We probably spend more time beating ourselves up for not writing than we do actually writing. So understanding, right, that even like giving yourself downtime, right, is part of the writing process, so you can let your brain think about things or think
Right.
through things. So I'm doing something creative, and especially now that a lot of my creative work is really sort of targeted in at doing stuff at Albright, there's always a deadline, right? So it's like, okay, the show is in 3 weeks, right? So we gotta be ready. And then, for the academic, right, scholarship type book stuff is more set a schedule and make your way through it.
Right, and you must be a voracious reader because, did I say that right? Voracious? Voracious? I don't know, but you've read a lot of things.
Yeah, part of being a professor is part of your job is reading, which is pretty cool. I read a lot of stuff. In the field, you sort of have to, right? I'm a big history nerd, though, right? So I read a lot of history and things, and I've been sort of the last 2 years reading a lot about Reconstruction, right, and the 14th Amendment and all that stuff, and. And then I get sad about how that's exactly right. It's sort of like if you just change the names, it's pretty much exactly what's going on now.
Right. Yeah, 1864 laws are being reenacted, and I thought about a sketch for that. Women are going to have to wear corsets again and take cocaine and whatever.
Yeah, so I mean it's enlightening and depressing. It's like the exact same argument. They just sort of change the person who's saying it. And then I try to sneak in just some pleasure reading it as well, especially if I'm working on if I'm working on a creative piece. I like to be engaging with other creative work at the same time, to sort of be inspired, but also to channel energy into different places and stuff, right? I have a colleague, Jeff Lentz, who's an opera singer turned brilliant theater director, right? And whenever he's doing a piece, right, he almost always, right, will base it around, right, to sort of he'll usually pick a visual artist, right, and sort of immerse himself in that world and then let that inform, right, the theater work that he's doing. So I don't quite go the depth that he does, but the idea that like engaging with other things helps sort of keep your mind both occupied and firing, right?
Yes, and what are you reading right now?
Right now I'm going through Heather Cox Richardson's Democracy in America, which is enlightening and depressing at the same time. And then our June improv show, we do a thing called book club, and so we all pick a this time it's beach reads, right, so summer reading. So I haven't picked my book yet, so I'm open to suggestions on that. And then I'm doing I'm doing an evaluation for another school's theater department, so I'm reading through all of their documents and assessments, and
Oh my gosh.
thrilling reading.
What kind of reading did you say?
It's thrilling.
Yeah, it sounds exciting.
And then I'm actually doing a I'm the sort of last reviewer for, I guess I don't know if I'm allowed to say, for Ann Liberow's book Funnier, which is sort of a theory book about comedy. It's amazing. So I'm reading that before it's published, which is always exciting. But she's brilliant, and writing that book is so far amazing. So hopefully everybody will be reading that in a year.
I hope so too. Now, I want to go back to something that really intrigues me. It's your work on satire and your description of satire and your point of view on satire. And we could spend a whole hour, I think, just talking about that, Matt. But, in the next 55 minutes, let's have an exposition on what is satire? What does it mean to you? I love political satire in the age of post truth, which is a heady title. So let's hear your thesis about that.
Well, we are sort of the point of that piece, and then the book Satire in the State is that we've seen like this radical transformation in satire in the last like 15 years. So this idea of using comedy or humor to hold power accountable, essentially, right? As a way to sort of challenge authority and all those things, right? Ben Franklin, like, is America's, right, founding father of satire, right? Using humor to sort of cut through red tape. And so what we had seen for several thousand years is that what satire does is it finds sort of a nugget of truth, and then it exaggerates it out, right? And Jonathan Swift's The Modest Proposal is like the example of that, right? So, we'll look at, right, England's policies towards, right, poverty and Ireland, and we're going to exaggerate it out. And the exaggeration then is supposed to illuminate the truth. But now we live in a world where everything around us is so exaggeratedly absurd that you can't really exaggerate it anymore, right? Like Trump fell asleep at his trial yesterday, right? Like, how do you exaggerate it, right? You can't make that funnier than it is. And so what we've seen is kind of a reversal. So we try to find something absurd and pull the real out of it, right? Instead of the opposite. And I think the stuff that's been really effective in the last 10 years is the type of things that are doing that, right? So like Sarah Cooper's like lip syncing of Trump during the pandemic, where she released all those videos, were super effective because it was just what he's saying is so crazy. You just repeat it, right? And she just repeats it, and there, she adds in sort of a few like visual editorials, but it's like, in some ways, if you don't do it verbatim, an audience thinks you're exaggerating it. And then that sort of takes away, right, the truth that you're trying to find.
Right. Like, how can you heighten things that Trump says? I
Right.
mean, just the other day he was talking about the Gettysburg, and I mean, it was really like a drunk history show.
Right. And a good example, that's a great example, like McSweeney's, if you remember, he gave that weird, when he was talking about how Frederick Douglass is, people are starting to recognize him more and more. McSweeney's just posted that speech, right, as an article, right, just verbatim, right? The Daily Show, a couple years ago, right, Trevor Noah just did this bit where they just read a deposition about Trump talking about like tomatoes, right? And so it's just repeating it to sort of pull out the truth. And right, and that's coming up now, right? Where they're debating whether or not they should do debates, because Trump just lies the whole time. But right, if you remember back to 2020, that first debate, that was the right where he was just interrupting Biden all the time and like talking over him and saying all the crazy things. That was the first time a lot of people had sort of seen Trump unedited. And I actually think it was really helpful to Biden. Right, because you turn on the news and you get the sort of 20-second clip of Trump saying something, and it seems like, oh, whether you agree with it or not, it doesn't seem like it's insane. But then when you pull out, you look at the 5-minute clip, it's like, what the hell is he talking about? Right, so there's that sort of I don't, debate about, like, is it good to hear his full speech because it's insane, or is it bad to hear his full speech because it's insane?
Well, and then people believe it. That's the other thing. And you can't heighten that either. I mean,
Yeah, and so what? So, like, Trevor Noah repeating that transcript by doing it through the Daily Show, right? The sort of the medium, right? The context helps to amplify that this is absurd, right? So, and that's the struggle right now, that everybody keeps saying, like, Trump is so good for comedians, and it's like, no, he's terrible for comedians, right? If you think about Saturday Night Live, what they really want is, right, they want Gerald Ford, they want Sarah Palin, they want somebody that nobody knows, because then they can help craft that persona, right? You don't want Trump or Hillary or Biden because everybody knows them, right? So there's nothing new to say about them. And so it makes satirizing them hard.
so where do you see satire going in your work?
In my work, a lot of it is balancing that sort of verbatim satire, right, of figuring out how to do that. The 2020 sketch show that we did, we sort of very purposely didn't, we took Trump and Biden out of the show, and we really sort of made it about the environment kind of around them, that sort of, right? So thinking about, like, systems, right? And power structures, and, how are the things, why are the things the way that they are, irrespective of those two? Because I think there's this weird, misguided notion that, like, oh, if Trump loses again, all of our problems are solved, right? And, he wouldn't be the nominee again if there weren't millions and millions of people who agreed with him. So to me, I think it's more useful, interesting to kind of be looking into the movement, right, more than just sort of the individual. And so that's what I'm more interested in now, sort of satirically. The Tom Hanks Black Jeopardy sketch on SNL, from a few years back, right, where he's sort of playing a MAGA supporter. And the underlying thing there is, like, right, different communities distrust the government for different reasons, right? And it's sort of an interesting, satiric point of view, as opposed to just, like, Trump is crazy, Trump is stupid. So I think that sketch, right, is doing more, and is more valuable than just, like, Trump talks funny.
I start thinking back on some of the early SNL sketches, like when Chevy Chase was doing Gerald Ford, and when they were portraying Reagan, the Girl Scout scene.
Yeah, that's such a great sketch. Right, again, because it has such a clear, like, thesis statement, right? And the Ford stuff is, obviously it was sort of like the first one, so it, takes on greater import. But, like, the fact that Chevy Chase doesn't even try to impersonate him, fascinating. Right, and I think we kind of see that again in Sarah Cooper. I mean, she just puts on a blazer, right? But she's not, like, physically trying to be him. And so I think there's, like, something key there, that we've become So much of our satire has just become like impressions. And so then you lose, the thesis statement, right? Of so I think that's kind of like a key to sort of contemporary satire is balancing that sort of impression versus actually saying something.
Now, I did notice that every 4 years you publish a book. So your last book was 2020. I wanted to ask you if you're working on something now.
Yeah, so I've got a new one coming out in September. It's called 50 Key Improv Performers from Theater, Film, and Television. And it's probably the hardest book that I've had to write because anytime it's sort of like a list book, then, the immediate, the first immediate thing is like, well, why is this person on the list and not that person?
Exactly. Yeah, I love that part where you talk about that.
So I really tried. There are way more than 50 people in the book. So I really tried to sort of frame it in ways where I could include as many people as possible. And it also felt sort of antithetical to improv to isolate out individuals in a form that is so dependent on collaboration. Right. So, I mean, obviously, there's like, you have to talk about Viola Spolin and Keith Johnstone, right? And Mick Napier. But I also tried to like include groups and theaters and like movements and groups of film directors and things. Yeah, so there's way more than 50 people in there. And it was definitely the hardest book that I've ever had to write. Just because it's sort of this constant, should this person be here? Should that person be there? And like, what are my blind spots? What am I missing? When somebody picks this up and they flip through and they're like, how did you leave out, right, person X? And it's really, the hope is that it becomes something, right, that people talk about and somebody's like, I can't believe you included X and not Y. And so now I'm going to go write something about Y. I think like as a improv, historian, scholar, like it's mind-blowing to me that there's not a definitive biography of Viola Spolin, right? Like, how do we not have that? So hopefully somebody will be take it and they'll go write that. I'm not a biographer, so I don't, it's like too important of a book. I don't want to mess it up. So hopefully it's something where people can kind of like look at it and maybe, right, see a few folks they don't know, learn a few things about people they do know. Like the Brave New Workshop is in there, right? And that's sort of one of those theaters that always kind of gets left out of things. And looking at sort of there's sort of, I guess there's kind of like a big distinction between Anglophone, like English language improv, and like Francophone, right, where a lot of the sort of Francophone world does this thing called the match, which is got developed in Montreal, and it's sort of like comedy sports but set to hockey, and then like that exported out to like a whole bunch of places. So they're like all these places that have nothing to do with hockey, like they probably never played hockey in their country before, but they do the match, which is just sort of fascinating to me. Right. And then, looking at like in the English world, like, right, who's doing short form, who's doing long form, who's mixing them together, right, where are the innovations coming from? And looking globally at like, speaking of sort of Amy Seaham's book, the different waves of improv, right? And so she kind of breaks the history of US improv into these different waves. It's like Compass and Second City, and then IO, and then like The Annoyance and Upright Citizens Brigade. And seeing different parts of the world that are in like different waves, right? And how, right? And so how are they kind of like learning from the waves, right, that other places went through? Right. So, waves, other places are tend to be more compressed because they've already sort of gone through those. And then how did, the pandemic In a lot of ways, actually, sort of became this big catalyst for global improv. And a lot of folks in interviews talked about, we didn't have access to somebody from Second City or The Annoyance or Theater Sports and Keys Johnstone beforehand, but now everybody's doing stuff on Zoom, and so now we can do a master class, right, with the masters of improv. And so it really was a way to like connect people and like speed up some areas, sort of, I don't know, learning curve is not the right word, but sort of jumpstart what they're doing. So that was kind of cool to look at. There's Wrigley. So that's the next book that's coming out. So I'm pretty excited about that one.
Well, I noticed that behind you there's clocks with different time on it. Not like international times, but one says 12, another
Those
says 10 after 11.
our kids when they were born. We had them all take a picture with my glasses on when they were babies, and that's the time they were all born.
Oh, I love that. Oh, that's really sweet. I'm sure you're a great father too. A lot of fun.
Most of the time, yeah. Sometimes, right, dad loses patience, but
Yeah, that's normal. Or though, what is normal? Well, this has been so illuminating for me. I am so glad we had this opportunity to chat. Maybe when your next book comes out, we'll chat again about that. Because I just admire your work so much, and I am a history improv nerd. I love it. I totally love it. And one of the things I did with my podcast is try to find people who were part of early improv, although that's kind of hard to find. But Carol Sills, Paul Sills' wife, and talking to some of the early folks. So this has been so enjoyable for me.
Well, no, thank you for having me, and thank you for doing stuff like this. I mean, as I think Jeannie said this too, but like, so much of improv's history is not written down anywhere. So it's great to have you doing all these interviews and documenting all this stuff and getting all these people on record and things. Because there aren't a lot of, we do the show and it disappears, so there's not a lot of records in improv. So like, this kind of thing that you're doing here and is amazing, right? And it's so helpful. Like when I was doing the 50 Key Improv books, I mean, I listened to maybe 9,000 podcasts, right? So they're like, I mean, I'm obviously exaggerating, but like this is such an important record. So thank you for doing this and interviewing all these amazing people.
And I have to say, if you ever taught online, I would be the first to sign up.
We'll see. I don't know.
So thank you again for being my guest. Have a super duper day, and congratulations on all your beautiful work and successes, Matt Fotis.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye now.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast and look forward to you joining us next time on Improv Interviews with Margot Escott.